Welcome to Recent Developments in the Management of Relapsed Refractory Multiple Myeloma, what happened at the ASH 2025 meeting, with a focus on BCMA-targeted therapy and investigational agents. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Sagar Lonial from the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, to discuss key papers from the ASH meeting.
This, to me, if there were two bells of the ball, the TECDARA would have been the first. This was a late-breaking abstract that initially reported on three patients with an in vivo CAR, and then at the meeting actually reported on a fourth patient. This, to me, is a really exciting opportunity because in vivo CAR functionally means that you don't have to do the apheresis, you don't have to do the bridging, you don't have to do the lymphodepletion. That's all associated with the traditional CAR T-cell. What you're giving them in this product is actually viral particles that have a tropism for T-cells, get incorporated into T-cells, and then basically force that T-cell to become a CAR. And so you don't have to do any of the ex vivo culturing, quality manufacturing, all of that stuff goes away. You basically infuse them with the viral particles, and then about 2 weeks later, you start to see T cells that are CAR T cells begin to develop. And so this, to me, is probably one of the most exciting approaches to CAR T cells because it gets rid of all of those middle steps. And so obviously, this is a first-in-man study, so we had a lot of questions about safety, efficacy, all those kinds of things. What you'll see is that all three patients achieved MRD negativity at 10 to the minus 5. A fourth patient did as well, but again, only 6 weeks into their initial infusion. What happened to their involved free light chains? They all went down to zero. The M spikes also dropped pretty dramatically, as did soluble BCMA. Now, if you're really looking at this data critically, you're going to say, why did the free light go to zero but the M spike didn't? Well, we know that the M spike takes longer to go away. The free light half-life is just a few days. So we'll see very quick responses in the free light, but the M protein can often take 2 to 3 months to go away. So that's a more delayed response, which explains the disconnect between MRD negativity at 10 to the minus 6, as I just showed you in three of the four patients, and yet there is still a measurable M spike. So I think in that sense that we expect that that M spike will continue to drop. If you look at adverse events, we didn't see any ICANS at all. We did see some CRS, very low levels of CRS, there were a couple of other side effects. But I think, again, the fact that we did not see any ICANS or neurologic toxicity is really exciting, despite the fact that we saw pretty significant expansion of the CAR T cells overall. So I think the take-home message from my perspective is this is a really exciting first-in-man study. I think several centers in the U.S. are now ready to open this. We're a couple months away, we hope, from being able to open this study and treat patients and really understand what the relative benefit is of in vivo CAR versus the traditional ex vivo product that we've talked about through much of this discussion already.
But just to be clear, is this an off-the-shelf or autologous?
Yes. It is an off-the-shelf viral particle that creates an autologous product. So it's all done in the patient. Yeah.
Has this type of strategy been used outside of myeloma?
Yeah, there outside of myeloma, I'm sure. So there was a report that was published in Nature about 4 months ago from a Chinese company giving a single patient an in vivo CAR product similar to this, and they demonstrated efficacy and depth of response as well. I'm sure this is being done in other diseases as well. I'm just not as familiar with it.
How do they do this?
Again, you create viral particles that on one portion target CD3. And then once the CD3 binds and that viral particle gets incorporated within the cell, it then forces that cell, similar to lentiviral transfection in ex vivo, only this is all happening in the patient with a targeted viral particle. And so far, they're showing that the particle doesn't get incorporated in other tissues, which is a concern.
So again, naive question, but so are you saying they create a viral, I guess it would be viral-like particle because it's not actually a virus, or is it?
It is a replication-incompetent lentiviral vector, yes. So it can't divide. The virus cannot divide, but it is basically a virus that gets into the cell with a CD3 tropism. So it binds only to CD3. That's how it gets in.
Wow, interesting. I didn't realize that.
The next two studies we're going to talk a little bit about are studies that looked at belantamab, and these are updates of the DREAM-7 and the DREAM-8 clinical trial that were updated at ASH 2025. And what we really began to look at are the long-term responders in patients who received belantamab mafodotin or belamaf, and some of the characteristics that demonstrated that they would ultimately go on to be long responders. And what we know overall, again, is that these patients who did have long-term responses had a very high overall response rate, and almost all of them achieved a VGPR or better within the first few cycles of therapy, which is really encouraging because that rate clearly was higher in the Bela arm than in the control arm for both of these trials. So if you look, for instance, at the group of patients that were overall responders or long-term responders in the Bela group, you'll see 92% of them achieved a VGPR or better in the DVD arm compared to 96% in the Bela arm. If you look at the non-long-term responders, it was about 50% in the Bela arm and only 30% in the DVD arm. So clearly better and deeper responses early on. If you begin to look at MRD negativity, 75% of them achieved MRD negativity at 10 to the minus 5 in the Bela arm, compared to only 61% in the group that was not considered a long-term responder in DREAM-7. And so overall, many of those patients had fewer lines of prior therapy, and they achieved deeper responses early on, and their safety signals were not significantly different than what we saw in the patients that didn't necessarily achieve deep and long-term responses. If you look at the same subset in DREAM-8, DREAM-8 was Bela plus Pom-Dex versus PVD as the control arm. Again, you're seeing MRD negativity rates in the Bela arm of over 35% in some arms, depending upon how you slice and dice the data overall. If you look at sustained MRD negativity, it was about 15% on the intent to treat group in the Bela arm compared to only 3% in the PVD arm overall. And again, the median progression-free survival is 33 months, which in many ways puts it on par with what you see with a CAR T cell. And yet the dosing frequency for Bela in this trial was every 8 weeks in the first few cycles, and then it spread out to every 12 weeks. So much less frequent dosing. And this to me really is an important take-home lesson from both DREAM-7 and DREAM-8. And that is, don't feel like you need to be married to the every 3 week dosing schedule. It's okay to spread the doses out. And as we learned from DREAM-2, most patients actually stabilize or improve their depth of response despite holding the drug. So I think the goals are achieve deep responses, and those can translate to long remissions.
So, you know, we just got back from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, where breast, they have 4 and soon to be 5 ADCs approved. And, you know, all week long, we were talking about all kinds of toxicities from mucositis neutropenia, diarrhea, ILD, all kinds of problems. And I was thinking about the fact that, you know, belantamab really doesn't have a lot of that. It seems like it's mainly the ocular. We'll get to that in a second. But what I wanted to ask you about is the payload. Like, what is the payload, and how does it compare to other ADCs that, you know, we see again throughout oncology? And is that the reason you don't see more toxicity?
Yeah, I mean, I think you do see some hematologic toxicity. That's fairly manageable. Again, we're a blood cancer, so that's not really as big an issue. The corneal issues are seen with this payload, so it is different. And remember, it was specifically chosen to not cause neuropathy. Many of the payloads that are used in antibody drug conjugates have neuropathy as the major side effect. And this one was, because myeloma patients are at risk for neuropathy, that was specifically taken off the table. So yes, with any therapeutic, you're going to end up with some adverse events. You know, when I talk to my colleagues who are ophthalmologists about this, their first response to me is, we got that covered. Don't worry about it. You worry about treating the cancer. And I think there's just this predisposition of fear. And the more you use the drug, the more comfortable you feel with this side effect.
But I guess my question, I assume this is a chemo payload?
Yes. Yeah. Betanzanoids.
And I didn't realize that it was developed. How did they do that to try to develop it with the idea of not, like, just clinically they were looking for something, or was it more biologic?
Yeah, I think it was clinically they were looking for a payload that wouldn't cause neuropathy. So many of the ones, for instance, in lymphoma that have neuropathy right. as a side effect, those ones were specifically avoided for that reason. The next two studies we're going to talk a little bit about were longer-term follow-ups of the CARTITUDE 4 study. And the first was looking at long-term progression-free survival for cilta-cel in the standard risk early relapsed patient population. And the second was really looking at immune fitness and immune effects based on correlative studies that can predict outcomes looking at the microenvironment of patients who got this. So let's start off looking at the data presented by Dr. Costa. And what he was really doing was looking at longer-term follow-up of CARTITUDE 4. And what we know from CARTITUDE 4 is that at 30-month follow-up, 76% of patients were still alive in terms of overall survival, compared to only 63% in the standard of care. And you'll recall the standard of care was Dara-Pom-Dex for a majority of patients. There was another Dara combination in there as well. But in general, it was shorter progression-free survival favoring the CAR T-cell. And now we're seeing shorter overall survival favoring the CAR T-cell as well. What I thought was really interesting is looking at the subgroups based on standard risk and high risk. And what I think you'll notice is that in the CAR T-cell group, both standard and high-risk patients treated with 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy had a longer progression-free survival than the standard risk treated with standard of care. And so what that says to me is that obviously the two curves in aggregate are better than standard of care, which we already knew. But even the high-risk cohorts of patients did better than standard risk treated with standard of care. So I think this, to me, really speaks to the potency of a CAR T-cell in this context. And again, if you look at overall survival, both favored the CAR T, both standard and high-risk, compared to standard of care, where the curves were lower. What I think this really speaks to is many of us have a thought that in first relapse, we're going to think about a CAR T for high risk. Functional high risk, that's easy. That's a no-brainer. We want to do that. But it really pushes the envelope a little bit on, should we really consider this for the standard risk? Because they seem to gain even greater benefit in terms of progression-free survival by being treated earlier with a CAR T cell overall. The next analysis from Dr. Parikh's data set suggests that about a third of patients in CARTITUDE 1 are in remission at 5 years and ongoing remission. So 5 years is what we think we're going to use to define cure in myeloma. And roughly a third of patients from CARTITUDE 1 clearly met that endpoint. And in patients with CARTITUDE 4, having a tissue microenvironment that favored longer remissions was in fact associated with a better progression-free survival. So there are factors we can look at both in the bone marrow as well as in the blood that may predict for better immune fitness, and that immune fitness ultimately leads to longer remissions after CAR T-cell.
So let me ask you a basic question that's been out there for a while. It kind of sounds like you're saying maybe a third of these patients are cured.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly the operational discussion that we're having right now. I think that there were 12 of those, I think it was 30 patients, that actually had MRD negativity and PET imaging done all the way through 5 years. For those 12, I think the answer is yes. I think there's a high chance that those patients are cured. For the other ones, we don't have the MRD data done because they came off study at a certain point. And so it's a little bit harder, but certainly encouraging that we're seeing a potential plateau at 60-month follow-up.
And how would you indirectly compare? I don't know if there's as much data for IDACEL. Again, chance for 5 year, you know, MRD negativity or cure.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we know about IDACEL is that that plateau, if it exists, is significantly lower. And I'm not sure that it's there. Certainly not without maintenance. And one of the things that our group presented at IMS last year was our PFS for both Ciltacel and IDACEL treated at our institution. And we tend to use maintenance therapy for a year after CAR T-cell. And our IDACEL PFS was longer, and our Ciltacel PFS was also significantly longer as well. So what we saw from CARTITUDE 1 in this last analysis was without maintenance. It was simply looking at the CAR T-cell itself. The next abstract really focuses on the use of tocilizumab to reduce the incidence and severity of cytokine release syndrome. And this is an analysis that was brought to us from Memorial Sloan Kettering. And in many ways, and I'm going to say this with a shameless plug, mimics much of the data that we've published in the last year looking at preemptive tocilizumab to try and reduce the incidence of CRS for outpatient administration of bispecifics. And so if you look at what they did was they gave a dose of tocilizumab as prophylaxis and demonstrated that they could, in fact, significantly reduce the incidence of CRS from as high as 70 to 80%, which is what's reported in most of the phase 1, phase 2 studies with all the bispecifics. You could reduce that to about 20% by giving preemptive tocilizumab. And this, to me, just makes common sense. We talk about the use of preemptive G-CSF when we think the rate of febrile neutropenia or neutropenia is going to be over 30% when we give chemotherapy. And so we do give G-CSF. In my mind, you've got a patient population where the average age is over 65. Why do you want to give them a heart rate of 120? What's the reason to make them feel sick? Particularly if you can cut that rate by almost 75%, by giving a single dose of tocilizumab that really has pretty much no side effects at all. And so I think that this data set really demonstrated that in another center, you can get that same significant reduction in CRS that, again, makes this easier for outpatient administration.
You know what I think is a little confusing for oncologists is that, you know, they hear all these great things in myeloma, and yet lymphoma CAR T, they don't do this. And I'm not even sure they've looked at it that much. I'm not really sure why. You think there's more CRS with CAR T in myeloma?
I have been begging our lymphoma colleagues to add tocilizumab to their bispecifics. I think, quite honestly, we're a little bit more likely to go off the reservation in myeloma. And so we started this process almost 18 months ago and switched to outpatient therapy relatively quickly. It reduces the burden or need for hospitalization and acute care in the context of CRS.
I guess at least in lymphoma, you have mosunetuzumab, which is very, very well tolerated, very little serious CRS. So I don't know if that's the issue. But, I mean, any of the bispecifics with CAR T that you so little CRS that really this is not worth doing, or do you do it with all the bispecifics?
We do with all the bispecifics, and now we're doing it with CARs in order to reduce the incidence. And you know,
really?
Again, if you think about it purely from a biology perspective, high IL-6 makes myeloma cells more resistant. So there's actually a good biologic reason to say, let's drop IL-6 levels to potentially make you more sensitive to therapy. We're going to talk now about an update of the REDIRECT-1 clinical study with now 3-year follow-up. this was a combination of talquetamab and teclistamab. So talquetamab targets GPRC5D, teclistamab targets BCMA, and it was the idea of using both of these targets together without any other therapeutic approaches in the treatment of relapsed and refractory myeloma. So this was a phase 1B study, phase 1B mostly because we were combining two drugs that had not been necessarily combined before. And what you'll see now is overall response rates between 80 and 90% overall. The main side effects were what you'd expect. With the talquetamab, you did see a higher incidence of infections. With talquetamab, you saw a little bit more skin and gut-related toxicity. But because the dosing of this was a little bit different, it was mostly grade 1 and grade 2 adverse events that were seen in the redirect 1 trial. What I think is really interesting is that what we know also from the redirect 2 trial, which was published in the New England Journal right around the time of ASH 2025, is that it has significant activity in extramedullary disease. And so while I may not think about TEC and TAL together for every patient with early relapse disease, in patients with high risk or extramedullary disease, it appears to have really good activity and I think would make a lot of sense in that context.
So I guess in a way it kind of asks a classic question in oncology of do you give two drugs together or give them sequentially? Aside from this issue of extramedullary, any hints here that maybe in the long term you would see better long-term efficacy by combining as opposed to sequencing them?
Yeah, and the long-term follow-up is still, it's a still relatively small number of patients. The Monumental 9 trial is going to look at this in a larger phase 3 experience. So I think that's where we're going to get the answer to your question. But I think for me right now, I'm reserving this combination for patients that fit that extramedullary bill until we have better data in terms of both dose and schedule, because I think that's an important wrinkle in this combination, as well as duration of treatment that's necessary. And again, fixed duration is where we want to get. What is the optimal duration of therapy?
So does that mean you actually have used this combination outside of trial?
Yeah, yeah,
really?
We have an order. We have an EPIC order set that is geared towards this, and we're actually again using it in patients with that extramedullary high risk disease. Yeah.
Any patient pop into your mind with extramedullary disease where you saw an unusual response?
Yeah, I mean it's like magic. The extramedullary disease will melt. You can see it in many in many patients. Yeah, yeah. They're mostly my colleagues, and I joke with them because while they probably get the sicker patients than I do, I joke that my patients don't get quite that sick. but certainly many in our group have seen that shrinking of multiple foci of extramedullary disease with TEC and TAL together.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Loniel, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Recent Developments in the Management of Relapsed Refractory Multiple Myeloma. What happened at the ASH 2025 meeting? Focus on BCMA-targeted therapy and investigational agents.